welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at those times. And we also bring you these programs via podcasts. That is correct. And you can listen to those podcasts either on the homepage of RichardDugan.com or the radio show's page, or SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, and so forth. And we encourage you to do that because I think that you're really going to enjoy, I think, the programs. At least I hope you are. I enjoy bringing them to you. Have a great lot of fun talking with our guests. And I just can't think of any other way to spend my time and talking with our guests here on the program. We also have available, of course, an email address if you would like to send us some ideas for guests. We would love to hear about those. And also, if you would like to support this program, we can use all the help we can get. We have a PayPal account that's set up for you to do that. And that link is on the homepage above the players for SoundCloud, as well as on the missions page. So any amount is greatly appreciated. And I have to tell you that I am beyond, almost beyond words. This would be a very quiet program if I were beyond words. In reference to thanking you for participating financially in the program, if you've done so, energetically, if you've done so, we'll take that too. We're not that picky. We are not tax deductible. We are not nonprofit. Okay, so keep that in mind. I don't want to get in trouble with the guys upstairs. And hey, enjoy the broadcast. I want to share something with you, audio-wise, that I think, when I first heard the title of this book, this is what came to mind.
Here in our studios, that controversial communications expert, that wonder of the electronic age, Mr. Marshall McMedium.
How do you do?
Mr. McMedium, you proclaim that the medium is the message is the medium.
Or vice versa.
Well, the title of the book is not The Medium is the Message. The title of the book today is called The Mind is the Map. And I figure the map must be the mind. Well, we're going to find out from the co-author of the book, Christina Reeves, here on the program. Christina, thank you so much for joining us on the program. I hope you don't mind my taking liberties with that little satire.
Actually, it was quite nice. Thank you, Richard. Yeah. I'm happy to be here, and thanks for the opportunity.
I believe the gentleman who that was satired after was Marshall McLuhan. I believe that's how it's pronounced. And he was kind of that way. He was very convoluted in some of his wise sayings. Very, very interesting. So when I saw the title of your book, I thought, that just immediately, for some reason, reminded me of that. By the way, folks, the subtitle is Awareness is the Compass, and Emotional Intelligence is the Key to Living Mindfully from the Heart. Now, I have to say, Christina, that, and I don't really like putting people into categories or boxes per se, but parts of our society, media in particular, like to say that when it comes to solving problems, the left, the progressives, they're all emotional. That's all they deal with is emotion when trying to solve problems. And if it's the right, there is no heart. It's just all brass tacks and, you know, it's just cut and dry. There's no black and white. It's, you know, there is only black and white, if you will. And it's hard answers, and it's too bad if you get hurt, you know, because that's life. Life is painful, kind of thing. And I'm thinking there's got to be somewhere in the middle that we can meet and allow the heart and the mind to work together. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about. I've heard about this concept of emotional intelligence. I never really thought of emotion per se as being or having some level of intelligence. Describe it for us, if you would, from your perspective, especially from the work you have here, The Mind is the Map.
Yes, emotional intelligence is really using our emotions and passing them through our heart, Richard. And when we pass everything through our heart, we tend to come up with better responses and definitely better answers. Emotional intelligence is really what makes us tick. We observe and we identify our emotions, our thoughts, and we're able to recognize our patterns. It allows us to use discernment and wisdom to generate more choices for us. You know, we actually can turn possibilities and opportunities into personal realities just by feeling and understanding our emotions, by knowing what our thoughts are clearly, and, of course, our free will, our willingness to for the best outcome for all.
Yeah.
So cultivating emotional intelligence is one of the most powerful ways to transform our life. And we do this by becoming consciously aware of our beliefs and feelings about ourselves.
You have a chapter in here which I went to, and I thought it was very interesting. And I don't usually do this because I like to just talk to the guest from the heart, from their heart, and so forth. As opposed to, on page number 67, I talked about that, and so on and so forth. But in this case, it's on page 96, chapter 6. The mind is not free to be happy. And there's also a word that's defined in a sketch on the opposite page, eudaimonia.
Yes.
Eudaimonia. I'm not demodia, eudaimonia. and basically it's a noun, human flourishing, a state of being happy, healthy, and prosperous. Now, in our Declaration of Independence, it says that we are given these inalienable rights, and of them are, which means there are three listed, but there are others as well, life, liberty, guess what? We get those. And happiness. Oh, wait a minute. No, we don't. We get to pursue it, but we don't get to have it. Or do we?
That's a great point, Richard. Most of us would like to have a happier, healthier and more harmonious reality. In order to improve our reality, we really must understand the mechanisms of its creation, and that's really what most of the book is about. How do we create our reality? Most of us feel that things simply happen in our life, or that we just feel this way, or we just feel that way. But few of us actually delve in to investigate how our reality is created, and yet we create our own reality by the way we interpret and react to the events, the experiences that we're having in our life. And it's our belief system that actually creates our reality, what I call the writing on the wall.
I noticed that little quote as well, the writing on the wall. You know, I'm thinking, I don't want to talk about walls, okay? Enough. How about the writing on the curtain, you know, or the pull shade,
okay,
or something,
so
you know?
Can talk about that.
However, it is an excellent metaphor from the standpoint. I love this. There's a biblical passage, and obviously because of my upbringing, I kind of throw these in every once in a while. I'm trying to read more of the Bhagavad Gita and the Quran and some others, so I can throw some of those quotes in there. But in this case, it talks about how you should resist not evil. And I think of the metaphor there as a wall. And the wall is labeled evil. Or in this case, it's all of the belief systems that we have that are holding us back that are written on this wall. And the one thing that I kind of have theorized, and I'd love your comment on it, is it does absolutely no good and wastes our own personal energy to push against it, to try to climb it, or to try to go around it or under it. The best solution is to turn our backs and walk away from it. But I'm wondering if maybe that doesn't really solve the problem, because the wall is still there, and the writing on the wall is still there. So help us to put this metaphor into a better context.
Yes, we've all been taught, and it is, it's all our teaching. Many of our problems are simply the result of our own mistaken identity. We've learned to suppress what is naturally good within us, and we've learned to mistrust others, compete against them rather than cooperate and share with them. We've actually learned to be neurotic and fearful, if you want to sort of go that far.
Mm-hmm.
We've been taught that we must fight for what we need, even at someone else's expense. And such beliefs have been instilled in us in such a way of being smart or being successful. And many of us who have followed this philosophy find ourselves unhappy, isolated, secluded, and lonely. And that was me, too.
Well, I have to say that from my perspective, as I have been going through this life, and I'm going to have to say probably just over the last 4 years or so, I've been hearing messages constantly based on fear, trying to make me afraid. And it's almost as if, from my perspective, I don't want to play that game anymore. I'm tired of the drama. I had enough of that growing up, you know, in school. Had enough of that going through my first marriage in terms of the issues that we had to deal with. I had enough of that in one particular job that I had. I was there for, I think, about 9 months, and it was the worst experience I'd ever had, but I refused to give the employer or my supervisor the satisfaction of quitting. They had to lay me off to get rid of me. I just don't. It's like I'm so tired of this. Hell, and I'm only 59, okay? My dad is 88 this year, and I'm sure he's even tireder than I am. And unfortunately, he tends probably to watch the news every night and just get irritated to no end. But I'm curious as to how you, because most of my guests, when I talk to them, and I talk to them about their philosophy, I talk to them about the principles that they either have written about or they've taught about in workshops and seminars and so forth, I often ask them, so you've figured it out and you have made it to the other side, and that's why you're now coming to us, Christina, because you've made it, you've done it, and so now you can show us how?
Yes, I can. 25 years. There's two parts of knowledge, Richard, and I think, you know, I'd like to just point them out before we answer your question.
Okay.
And the first part, in my opinion, there's two parts of knowledge. The first part is, you know, the intellectual stuff, and that's the stuff we get from books, including my own, from programs, from workshops, from classrooms, lectures, so on and so forth. That's only one part of knowledge. The second part of knowledge is experiential. We must take this knowledge and we must internalize it. We must integrate what it is that we're trying to learn into our being. It's never, ever, ever about out there. 100%, it's never about out there. If we get triggered by something such as fear, as you say, and there's lots of it out there, we have to ask ourselves, what is it within me that I'm not seeing? What is it within me that's feeling this fear? No one can make you feel anything. Our feelings come from our thoughts, and our thoughts come from our programming and our belief system, which is the writing on the wall. So when we talk about, there are two common traps. We talk about awareness in the book, and there's two common traps with that, and one of them is passing critical judgment. You know, whether we're judging ourselves or whether we're judging the others, we need to recognize that that's a habitual pattern, and we need to retrain ourselves from making those negative comments. Another pitfall is taking offense. You know, it's another part of recognizing the patterns, and it's a struggle for many of us. In today's world, as you so rightly said, there's a lot of fear out there. We've been taught to take offense. Even for the most trivial matters, we've been taught to take a side, you know, and taking offense and feeling offended can quickly escalate into criticism, judgment, bitterness, and even lack of forgiveness. You know, when we're practicing emotional intelligence, we'll notice the other person's commitment or action, and instead of taking offense or taking it personally, we just consider it as data. People do what they do. And they do what they do based on the writing on the wall. And this writing on the wall happens between 0 and 6 years old.
I want to, first, before we go any further, I want to bring into our discussion your co-author, Demetrios Spanos, born in Athens, Greece. And it brings back some beautiful memories of radio program I used to produce back in the 80s, back in Phoenix, called the All New Greek Hour. And
wonderful.
Oh, yeah. And I learned only a couple of words of Greek. One of them was opa, and the other one was efaristo.
Yasu.
Yasu. And so anyway, but he, like you, has had a similar, shall we say, vision for humanity. You being a holistic life coach as well as an energy psychologist, we'll get into that as well. But he, of course, has been traveling all over the place, all over the globe, and spreading his particular version. But now the two of you have collaborated, and you've created, oh, there's that that word again, the center, the Eudaimonia.
Eudaimonia Center, yes.
Eudaimonia Center. And where what do you do there?
It's a school. You know, it's and right now it's an online school. We do have a physical location. In fact, I just finished some of the construction on the main level. We just had construction done on a studio and brought someone aboard who can help us make our videos and so on and so forth. I haven't been down there in a while. I'm actually going down next weekend to New York and do a walkthrough of the site. Our book came to life in sort of a magical and serendipitous way. We live in different countries. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's in New York with his family, and I'm here in Canada, just outside of Toronto. And we've been responding for years to each other's Facebook posts. And I mean, we had some pretty deep and meaningful conversations on those about, you know, life and about spirituality, about, you know, our devotion, you know, to our Creator. And many of our friends were privy to our writings. And it was actually these wonderful friends that encouraged us not once, but many, many times, asking us, when are you guys going to write a book? And so we decided to do that. And from a distance of that, pages were flying back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And at one point, we even thought we were done. And we had a publisher, and the publisher was ready to publish. And we looked at each other and said, I don't think we're done yet. So we went back to the drawing board for another couple of years.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, for some, they can whip it out in 10 minutes. And others, it can take 10 years. And I'm a prime example of that. I'm headed for the 19th year here, working on mine. But I've actually set it aside. It's like, if it's taken this long, then it's not ready yet, and I'm just going to relax and not concern myself with those details at this particular point in my life.
Yes, and you're right. You know, you talked just a moment ago about pushing and pulling the energy, mm-hmm. and that's something we don't want to do. It just needs to flow.
Yeah.
Good choice.
Now, when the two of you I'm curious as to, first of all, actually how the two of you met and realized that there was a connection, at least energetically, as far as the work that the two of you are doing that led you to create and found and create this center.
The connection with Grace. Can you believe that, Richard?
I can.
Okay, the connection with Grace. I've been going to Greece every year for about 30 years. My husband was Greek. And many, many friends and family on the other side, and own a property on one of the islands. So one of my friends has the last name of Spanos. And we were on my computer one day, and she said to me, this Spanos guy, we have relatives that we've lost track of in New York. Can you send him a note? Maybe he's part of our relatives. And I said, Bianca, I don't want to do that. Yeah, do it. So I sent him a note, and I just asked him that question, and my response was, no. No. And it was about a year later or so, and a friend of mine from Greece sent me a wonderful video with Nana Mouskouri music in the background. And I thought, boy, that's gorgeous. That's beautiful. And so I sent it out to Greek friends, and he was on my Greek list. And when he got it, he responded, and we started chatting on Facebook. From then, I started, he invited me to be a friend, and I started reading some of his posts, and they really are amazing, and they really are deep, and responding to them. He sort of brought me out of myself, if I can say that, you know. Mm-hmm. I've always liked to be invisible for some strange reason. Again, that's writing on my wall. And he was, his writing prompted me to want to respond, you know, and the discussions got deep and deeper, And that's when our friend said, you guys are writing a book here. This is amazing. Keep going. So when we were discussing both the content and the format of the book, we were sort of, we both felt that there's a lot of personal empowerment books out there, you know, but what we wanted to do was it needed to be inspirational. It needed to offer great advice. And I'm one that likes solid scientific facts, you know, show me.
Yeah, yeah.
Prove it. And then we wanted to include some of our personal experiences of what it takes to live happy and successful lives.
I know that, that we're all looking for that, but in your model, or map, I guess I should say, which is contained within the book, The Mind is the Map, you have, and I have to, first of all, comment and compliment you and or the publisher, you and Demetrius or and or the publisher, for the images that appear in the book as well. I don't know why. They're not the most vibrant of colors, but they still pop. They still pop out at me. Like the mind is the map. You have the upper half, and we'll view it from the clock perspective. From 9 o'clock around the top to 3 is part one, which is the process. And then from 3 around back around to 9 is part two, cultivating the journey, which we will talk about more. But in the center, what I like to call the pivot point, you have finding joy. But then you have 12 steps, if you will, or positions on the clock that are each described. And obviously, we wouldn't have time in an entire broadcast unless we went 2 hours or something, which I suppose we could do if we had the time to go through. But I like it, especially because of the colors. And I am one of those individuals who has, I believe it's, I think it's called kinesthesia, something like that. Where I see numbers and letters as colors.
Oh, really? Wonderful.
And then I put those numbers and letters together, and they create different hues and colors and so on and so forth. And so when I look at your rainbow array of colors on the palette of this clock, if you will, clock face, and I start going around, and it's just, I find it fascinating. One of them, of course, is understanding our patterns. That's actually number one. And then our life force energy and so on and so forth. And we go all the way around. But am I correct in understanding that the central focus of all 12 of these steps is to lead us towards finding joy? Or if you want to say happiness, I suppose you could put that in there. Or do you see those two as maybe slightly different things?
I talk a little bit about it in the book of 3 levels of happiness. It's happiness that actually brings you joy. And eventually, after we've tamed our critical voice and erased and replaced the writing on the wall to writing that served us better for our patterns, we will learn to live from a place of awareness. And Richard, that is possible. You know, I live in awareness most of the time. I very rarely get triggered. It's taken a long time to get there. But living in awareness means stepping back from every experience, getting a broader perspective, seeing yourself in the experience, seeing the experience itself. Is it you? Is it anything to do with you? Maybe it's not even your experience, so why are you in the soup? And watching the others in the experience. So, you know, the process of awareness has those three parts. We are the observer in the experience. We see the experience, and we're also looking on what our actions, never mind the, it's not critical, it's not judgmental, we're not looking at the other's actions, but we're looking at how our actions and reactions are affecting the others. It's a very powerful place to live from. And eventually, you know, we can break down those patterns and live in this place of awareness where there isn't anything that doesn't happen, where you're not able to step into this mindful place and produce meaningful practices, I guess. We soften our habitual routines back into mindful and meaningful practices.
So
and the softening...
Go ahead.
And the softening and breaking down of those patterns, Richard, is not about eliminating our humanness. It's not about eliminating our emotions, any wants or desires. It's just only about curbing the stubborn ways we hurt and disrespect ourselves and others. So often we go looking for ourselves when we're not.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, it would take me a long, long time to irritate you enough to where that you would react instead of act.
Yeah, I think, you know, the whole thing about responsibility is our ability to respond even when we get hijacked.
Yeah.
You know, struggling with our feelings and emotions and trying to apply logic and reason won't be helpful once the mind's hijacked. We've got 6 seconds, roughly, to step into awareness from the point of noticing the trigger before we go into overwhelm with our emotions. You know, we need to step in to awareness, you know.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, excellent point. And it's sort of that technique of, okay, I'm going to count to 10 before I respond to what you just said. And then I was thinking 3, 4, 8, 9, 10. I'm sorry, what was the question? You know, you've completely diffused it, and you move on to other things, hopefully.
Absolutely. And from that place, you know, no final hearing is likely to come from anywhere other than feeling our emotions fully and letting our wounds go down into our heart, you know, and allowing ourselves to live thoroughly through them, feel them fully. Our heart is much bigger than our wounds.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, this to me, it's this whole process of doing that. I had some problems in the last, I'd say in the last 8 years. I've been living here on the central coast of California. I needed to get to the ocean, but I didn't realize I was going to be getting to the ocean through Los Angeles, which was quite an experience in and of itself. And then dealing with drivers here in California. But of course, I've also been reading that drivers in Phoenix are not far behind unless they've taken the lead in their ways of driving. But someone shared with me through my frustrations through it all, and it wasn't necessarily road rage; it was just that frustration. They said, and this was a double-edged sword for me. They would say, "Richard, you have to understand that it's not personal." And immediately I said, okay, I get that, but I'm not happy with the fact that it's not personal. What, they don't care enough about me as a human being to make it personal?
There's the ego.
Yeah, there's the ego.
Exactly.
But once I did get to that place where I realized, hey, it isn't. They didn't wake up this morning saying, let's get Richard. I thought, okay, then setting aside the ego, then cut them some slack. They're not, maybe in the morning, they're not fully awake yet, and they're not really aware and conscious in the moment. And so I need to be double vigilant so as not to get in their way. Let them go their way and do their thing. Let me be fully awake and aware then and avoid them, you know, kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And that's
the
only way to do it.
Richard, our patterns are part of our human experience. When a pattern is triggered by an experience, like you say, driving on the LA freeways, we feel it by way of our emotions, and we habitually react to it. And we allow it to influence decisions and choices that can make us happy or unhappy.
Yeah.
And understanding these patterns can be considered a sort of a form of art, you know, requiring skills, awareness, creativity. The starting point, as your friend rightly said to you, is not to struggle with the pattern. Instead, just fully accept what's happening in the moment. Remain open to sensing, you know, that you do have a choice here. I know that's easier said than done.
Yeah.
The trigger. It takes a lot of practice.
Oh, absolutely.
To remain open in those intense emotional situations. We feel like we're defending our territory, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's another thing that's very interesting. I've been kind of looking at that, and I realize that it goes contrary to a lot of what we are taught and how we are educated / programmed to believe the way our society being the United States, is to function. You know, there's the idealistic view that is constantly pressed, and yet ego-centered ways of living are are exhibited, shall we say. The idealism is in the head, but the reality is, get out of my way, don't tread on me. That, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that came close to being the flag of the United States, don't tread on me. And in a manner of speaking... And in a manner of speaking, that's kind of where we are today. But it's gotten so individualistic. Don't tread on me. My opinion is the opinion. It's right, and yours is wrong. God is on my side, et cetera, et cetera. And I just sit here, not just from a national standpoint, but from a global standpoint. I'm going, how does this help us build a better society?
You're right.
You know,
you're absolutely right,
and I'm thankful that you're laughing.
And,
you know,
you're absolutely right. When we, few of us have very intimate knowledge of our patterns, Richard, and our negative reaction to the habitual patterns are where we can begin. You know, from a compost to fertile ground, so to speak, somewhere where we can plant new seeds. I don't know if you see this, but I do see big changes. I see a whole awakening. I see a whole, especially our millennials, you know, they're coming up with a different set of attributes for living lightly, for living a well-balanced life. And we need to celebrate those milestones by recognizing them and slowing down, each of us, to take a moment to feel what's true for us, instead of just reacting with our habitual responses. Our habitual patterns have positive contributions, you know, and others make us suffer and they deplete our energy.
Yeah. Right now, where our energy is just going right out the window. And I was talking with someone just the other day, and I said to them, I says, you know, and again, this is not a political statement. This is an observation from another human being on another human being, one human being to another. My observations of the present administration and a gentleman sitting in the Oval Office, this guy has got to be expending enormous amounts of energy to maintain what he's maintaining, not as the leader of the free world, but the tweets and the angry and all of that stuff. I got to tell you, I think I'd pass out after. I mean, we've seen him in our media and so forth for the last 4 years, and I can't believe he's, you know, the Energizer Bunny has got it over him, because at least the Energizer Bunny's got a battery. At least as far as I know, he doesn't have one.
We can turn him off.
But but my point is that that maintaining that kind of energy, it can't last.
It can't last, and we need to stop, Richard. We need to stop and think about what energy really does.
Yeah.
Okay, we can't add to that energy.
Right.
The more focus we put on the negative energy as a collective human society, you know, if we focus on what's going wrong, what's going to happen is energy builds on itself. Consciousness is all energy, and consciousness does what it does. It continues to expand.
Right.
And if we have, you know, many million people, you know, focusing on the negative energy of what we don't like, you know, or what we're hearing in the news and so on and so forth, we are adding an additional energy field to that. We're feeding it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
An energy field, if you focus on it for 1 hour, it'll double in size. Yeah. If you focus on it for 10 hours, you've increased that energy field of that particular issue tenfold. We need to stop doing that. I'm not saying that we put ourselves on a negativity diet where we don't, you know, pay attention to what's in the news and so on and so forth. But, Richard, we really need to do it from a place of awareness. We need to step back and observe. We need to be the observer. Nothing happens, as far as quantum mechanics tells us, without the observer. We need to sit back and we need to observe, and we need to choose where to put our energy.
You know, it's also been said that when we talk about the mind is the map, speaking of the map, if you overlay a meteorological real-time map over that, you see all kinds of things going on around the world as far as the weather's concerned. And someone said to me once that, just as a metaphor, what you see going on as far as, shall we say, I don't know, destructive storms or high energy weather patterns, whether it be the Polar Express coming down from the north, from Canada and so forth. Oh, by the way, thank you so much for that.
You got it, huh? Special delivery.
That's right. Or hurricanes or droughts or whatever they might be. This person said to me, says, you need to look at those adverse weather conditions in particular and then go inside and see where you are cold or you are hot and dried out or you are swirling around and spinning and so forth and on. You know, these, again, all metaphorically speaking. And then we take it to that level that you were just talking about, Christina, of a nation of people.
Yes.
Who are being led down a particular path of energy, regardless of what it is, just period, that they're being led down that path.
Sure.
And then you wonder why these things are happening, as you just stated. Quantum physics has shown us. And so, you know, we need to take a look at that. And, of course, then you can overlay also human activity around the world. If you've got all of these little skirmishes going on all over the place, you got to start taking a look inside of you and say, okay, what little skirmishes have I got going on inside of me, more metaphorically than literally, but by the same token, hey, maybe I should go see my doctor and get a test for this or that or the other just to make sure I don't have something, be preemptive,
right,
etc.
Fear-based.
because that's what happens. Matter of fact, my wife and I were watching this program the other night, and this man had been brought in, and they weren't sure whether or not this tumor that they couldn't get to, or this mass was cancerous or not. And the only way they could get it was to do a biopsy, but they couldn't get in to do the biopsy.
Okay.
So basically, they said, the option was this: either A, you do nothing, and it turns out that it's not malignant; it's benign. And you go on and live your life, or it turns out it is malignant, and you may have 4, 5, or 6 months. Or we can go in and try to remove it, and chances are higher that you could die on the table, or if you live, there might be a certain level of paralysis. After the surgery was over, and the man did live, they told him that we had to remove a nerve, so you are probably going to walk with a limp. To which he said, well, it doesn't matter. You've already taken it out. It's not like they can go put it back in and put it back the way it was.
Yep.
It was the people who were around him that he chose not to listen to. He didn't want to have any other input other than from the doctor and specific facts. Well, my wife was the same way when she was diagnosed with cancer in 2001. I didn't want people talking negatively around her. She didn't need that. She had enough on her mind as it was, and I knew that wouldn't help.
Absolutely. You're bringing up a very, very strong belief, you know, that I have, and somehow, and I'm doing this intuitively, Richard, I think you probably have the same belief. You know, if we really want to experience the joy, the joyful divinity of everything, we really need to let go of the illusionary feeling of separateness that's created by our senses.
Oh, yeah.
We're spirit here. We're energy and matter connected to each other and with all that is. And if we find ourselves living in this lower energy self, you know, whether it's someone out there putting it on us with their, you know, low energy, if we feel ourselves lost in the midst of pain and hurt, you know, we can always ask for guidance. The only expectation we can truly have is when we exchange our feebleness for faith,
mm-hmm.
and we engage in prayer with the full bluntness of our emotions and pain. Let it out, you know. It's in that moment that, for me anyway, I have the only absolute expectation that knowing that all is well.
Yeah.
We actively expect to be restored. We don't need to know how, what, or when, but this is where we'll find true and lasting joy.
The best phrase I've heard to put that into summation is, be part of the process. Don't try to control the process.
Yes, it's so true that our mind is always guided by external things, the past, and it keeps trying to contemplate and work out the future.
Yeah.
Essentially, our mind is in a constant interpretation of the past in survival mode towards the future, even when we get sick. However, when we rise above our thoughts and emotions, we begin to realize that between the perception of the past and the wonderful dreams of the future, there lays this magnificent presence, you know, the present moment.
Mm.
This is the most important moment of our life and the one that truly resonates with the soul that we experience in our body.
Yeah.
Need to stay there.
Yeah, absolutely. The mind is the map. TheMindIsTheMap.com is the website. My guest is Christina Reeves. She is the co-author of the book, which is Awareness Being the Compass and Emotional Intelligence, the Key to Living Mindfully from the Heart. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we will be right back.
Tell me your story.
And we are back here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And if you've been listening for any length of time, I have only this to say.
Well, there would appear to be more here than meets the ear.
And what is that, sir?
Well, there's a certain technological implosion at work in our culture. The world has become a mass electronic extension of man, which programs us far beyond the periphery of our previous fragmentized environment. Follow me?
Yes.
You follow that?
Yes.
Well, then, will you do me a favor?
What's that?
Would you mind explaining to me what I just said?
And sometimes when you're listening to this program, maybe you feel the same way. What the heck are they talking about? Well, I can tell you this much. You can find out just exactly what we're talking about by maybe re-listening to the podcast or going to themindisthemap.com, and you can find out more not only about Christina, but also about Demetrius Spanos, her co-author, and find out about how awareness is the compass and emotional intelligence is the key to living mindfully from the heart. Also letting you know, too, that one of the other aspects of this book is there are certain questions that maybe you have been wondering why we do what we do and why we keep doing that same thing again and again, even when we know better. That's almost akin to, and I wish I could remember who the quote is attributed to. It might be Einstein, I think, who says that the true definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. I mean, isn't that kind of what you're saying there?
Yep, that's Einstein, all right. The same brain that created the problem is never going to be the same one that's going to solve it.
That's the other beautiful quote. I think that until we can raise our consciousness to a level that that will have a different perspective. And quite honestly, that's what we do on this program, although I use the analogy of the points on a circle. And there's an event going on in the center of the circle, and what we do is we move around the circle, different points. We get a different perspective, and we broaden our point of view of that event so that maybe... another great one is, you know, there can be a car accident and 10 people will see it, but you will not get one single description from all 10. You'll get 10 different descriptions of what
Absolutely.
Happened.
Absolutely. What you see is not in the data. It's determined by our perception and our interpretation of the data. Very good, Richard. That's exactly it. And our perception, of course, is our belief.
Yeah, and you also commented earlier about science experiments, for example, and the observer. And I love the story of the scientists who were conducting this particular experiment. And every single time they did it, because they kept repeating it because they wanted to see if they could get the same result. In other words, sort of like a, I don't know, double blind study or what have you.
Yeah.
And they could never get the same result twice. And it took them a long time to figure out why. And they finally did. They finally realized,
you know, we're all unique.
Us.
Our programming, the writing on the wall is different. Our realities are different. I think what, you know, getting to what you were just saying about, you know, how things are shifting and they are changing. I believe that we're learning that everything that we've ever been programmed into believing was our reality is being shaken down to its very core. as more and more of us learn to think and act from our hearts, we will continue to break free from this controlled mind of the individual and come back, instead of the me, we're seeing the we. You know, we're seeing this in masses now. You know, people are more concerned, especially our millennium. They're coming out, and the main things that they're concerned about are turning the me to we. You know, it's a time for cooperation and for embracing these transformational processes. They're the only thing, frankly, Richard, that's going to help ease us through this, these big changes we're seeing on our planet right now. You know, the more we commit to knowing ourselves and at a heart level, the easier this transformation is going to become.
Well, I do hold out hope. There are times when I'm walking the main street here in Santa Barbara, it's called State Street, and
that's where
a lot of shops and so forth, and so many young people, but not exclusively, but many of the young people, their heads are bowed, their hands are in front of them, and I'm thinking, oh, good, they're praying. Oh, no, they're not praying. They're on their devices. And I think, we're doomed. We're doomed. And actually, that's a small percentage of the population that is doing this. And that there are many people, many young people who do care, who are trying their very best to make things work, to make this a better place.
I agree. I think there's more and more that are waking up to the fact that we can't keep continually running away from emotional vulnerability. You see the young people coming out and talking about depression. You see them coming out, you know, and speaking about their addiction problems. They're no longer hiding. They've decided not to hide. They know that others can benefit from this story. The level of inner balance and spiritual emotional maturity that we're able to accept, and these young people are, it's going to reflect in our relationship. It's sort of our spiritual assignment. You know, maybe that's our life purpose. I don't know. But definitely a new foundational template is emphasizing this change in human relationships, and I'm seeing it on a global scale, you know.
I'm sure you do some a fair amount of traveling as well, and you come across folks around the world and in the lectures or presentations that you give. And I'm curious as to the response outside of, say, Canada or the United States. Not that I'm saying that they're similar in that sense, because I've never been to Canada, so I don't know how different the lifestyle is there from here. Doesn't seem like it would be that much different in the cities. I know that there's a lot of wilderness out there too, but what's been the response by the general public, as you have observed, to this concept and of somehow finding a way to bridge that 12-inch gap from the brain or mind to the heart?
That's a great question.
Go ahead.
You know, and I am a world traveler. I think I've been to, I don't know how many countries around the world, but I also traveled for business for many, many years. And I am seeing it everywhere. I'm seeing each culture has a different set of issues that they're dealing with. But what I'm seeing is the fix to this is always the same. Benevolence is everywhere if we accept the responsibility. I remember giving a lecture in Europe, and this was millenniums again, and there was another lecturer there, and the lecturer actually turned the lecture over to me, said, you know so much more about this than I do. Would you mind taking this lecture? And, of course, they had many, many questions. You know, they're reaching for something. They're hoping for something. They seem to understand that whatever path, you know, we're on, whatever puzzles we must take and put back together again, that the secret of life has to do with this awakening. And it's so for all the history of all humanity, and it's a very humbling story of accepting our own unique life as it's revealed to us. You know, it's a collective story. It's an individual story, and it's one that requires all of our attention. It's also sweet, compassionate, never-ending in how we embrace ourselves and how we embrace each other. And as we find our place in the oneness of all that is, I see it everywhere.
Yeah.
Whatever difficulty that arises or crisis is we're experiencing, there seems to be a voice underneath, you know, that's speaking beneath our pain that will slow us down long enough to hear it and guide us to this transformation process.
And one of the thoughts that's come to me has to do with the fact that from the grand scheme of things, there is no moralization. And what I mean by that is that if you take a look at the cosmos and how it moves about, every so often, you know, there are what we would term collisions. You know, things run one into another, you know, and break apart or blow together or whatever the process is that the universe goes through. But it's neither good nor bad, right or wrong. Good or evil, it just is what it is. And
yes,
this
very good.
Concept
it is what it is.
Right.
And you know, our job is to accept that. You know, we want to create a foundation that's as strong as a concrete foundation on a house that can hold not only our lives in place, but all of life in place. Our spirit can't survive well with constant change. We feel like we're a feather in the wind, energy pushing us here and throwing us there. We thrive better with consistency and stability in our life. When the foundation of our life is healthy, it expands and supports our life more fully. We can take on more responsibilities. We can be creative and a whole lot more playful, Richard.
Yeah, absolutely. My boss back at a station in Phoenix that I worked for had us read, it was mandatory, the book called Who Moved the Cheese? I read the book cover to cover.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah,
yes.
I read the book cover to cover. And I went to him and I said, okay, I read it, and I just want you to know one thing. I don't have a problem with somebody moving the cheese. My problem is with them not telling me that they moved the cheese. I don't care if you move it. Just tell me where it is. Now, whether I got the
That's
point
good.
Or not, I don't know.
Very good. I like that.
But you're absolutely
yeah,
right.
Building a strong foundation anchors not only our life, but our life force energy in the physical plane.
Yeah.
You know, it ensures our survival and the quality of life that we live. We have to understand, you know, that we need that strong bound. We need that strong connection to our life force energy.
Tell me about your own philosophy, your foundation, if you will. Not where you are today, but how you got here. How did you get to this space? Where did you start from? Obviously,
Good question.
Probably as a child.
Happy to answer that. I'll be vulnerable here.
Okay.
I too had an addiction, Richard, and to avoid feeling things fully, to avoid looking deeply at my life, I felt very unloved as a child. I was taken from my home when I was 11. So I had lots of things going on, but I was one of those that just stuffed the bag. My addiction was workaholic. I became a workaholic. I built several very successful companies and was living a very high life, if you want to say that. But, Richard, I wasn't happy. You know, I just wasn't happy. It didn't matter. I lived in an 8,000-square-foot home on the water, had an airplane at John Wayne Airport. I had everything. I wasn't happy, and I went on a pursuit for happiness. At one point, I knew, because I had been on this path most of my life, you know, from a very young age, I've been meditating and on this path, but I was what you would call, I guess, a spiritual vagabond. I didn't integrate it. I had written journals. Journaling was how I released everything. Working was how I avoided everything. And when I finally decided to integrate it, you know, I felt that every area of my life was falling apart. And I was not happy at all. And I gathered all my my journals. I think I had 18 boxes full of, you know, those spiral notebooks. And I decided to take a sabbatical for a couple of years and really work on myself. And I did. And it wasn't easy. Some days I didn't want to come out from under the blankets. I had so many needs. You know, and my sister-in-law would call me in Greece, and she'd say, "Christina, what are you doing? You're crying all the time." And I said, "No, I'm not. I'm healing." She said, "Well, stop doing that. I can't stand you crying." And I said, "No, this is good for me." And I had a few epiphanies. And I actually walked. I actually gave myself a life review in this lifetime. I walked back through my entire life. And it was an amazing journey. It was sort of... it wasn't the big bang that I expected. You know, the shifts were small, but I got happier and happier. I paid more attention to what my present moment was like. I'm not saying that I didn't feel. The biggest thing I had to do was feel things fully. I had trained myself not to feel anything. I could feel for everybody else, but not for myself.
Mm. So I'm curious, and you're probably familiar with this, what I'm about to mention. So, did you handle your life review like Albert Brooks or like Meryl Streep in Defending Your Life?
I didn't defend my life. I actually called a conference of all my personas. I wanted to hear from each and every one of them. I wrote another book on that. I haven't published that one yet.
Oh.
And it's called, "Will the Real I Am Please Stand Up?" And I got to know when a persona entered me, if it was the one that felt unlovable or the one that worried all the time or the stoic one or whatever. And I could actually, it felt like sort of an interview with each one of them. And then, of course, my higher self pulling them all together, thanking them for the parts that they've played in my life. But it was time to become whole again. And this was an incredible journey, an absolutely incredible journey. I'm not saying that it didn't have painful moments. It did. But what I got out of it was absolutely an incredible, new, happy, joyful, peaceful, blissful life.
I'm curious as to whether or not you were able to, shall we say, clean the slate, or are you still having every once in a while to go back and maybe peel back another layer of that proverbial onion?
Yeah, absolutely. You think you've cleaned the slate. You know, this is always a work in process. You know, it happens very rarely now. I don't get triggered as nearly as often as I do, and I'm fully aware and want to look at things. I have developed a sense of curiosity and wonder, not only of myself, but of others and of all that is. And I love to live in this place. I think that's part of living in awareness. But yes, I got triggered. My mom died 3 years ago, and I was really triggered by that. I stomped around here for 3 or 4 days. She never loved me, you know, that kind of thing. And of course she did, you know, but me rejecting my mother, you know, was causing me not to feel her love for me. It's so convoluted. It's so twisted and tangled and, you know, swirling all together. But it's such a puzzle to take apart and put back together again. And when you do, your heart is stronger.
Yeah.
You know, your love is stronger. I really do live from a place of unconditional love now. I think that maybe that was my life purpose, to learn about love on all levels and come to the point where I could truly say I live with unconditional love for all.
You know, it's interesting the way you describe that, because, you know, it just makes me think that sometimes we have a certain experience from, again, as we talked earlier, from a particular perspective, and in this case, let's say, as a child. But what we were a part of from the omnipresent, shall we say, observer, if it were possible to do that, isn't necessarily the same thing. I was watching this program where this one adult all of a sudden was had heard this one phrase and kept going into convulsions. And it was a little overdone, but nonetheless, it was a reaction to that phrase. And he couldn't figure out why. So he began to tap into that, and he found the experience where this phrase was yelled at him over and over again. And then the memory started coming up, right? So he went to track down the person who had yelled this at him. And the story that this person told him was totally different from what he had created in his mind.
Sure.
Now,
absolutely.
Assuming, and we'll make this assumption for the sake of argument, assuming that that other person is telling you the truth, that the reason they said this was because they wanted you to do a specific thing, and they kept doing they kept yelling the phrase at you until you did it, was not because they didn't like you, they didn't love you, they didn't want you around. It's because they knew that you had to go over there and do this thing in order for you to continue on your path, if you will. Okay? So it wasn't a question of, it wasn't an issue of abandonment. It was a question or an issue of, shall we say, teaching. And those are two totally separate things, but the child's mind doesn't see that.
Absolutely. It's the story, you know. We have to step outside of our stories, okay? What happens is that when a child from 0 to 6 years old is wounded by something, okay, the memory of this is stored, but along with that memory, and, you know, with string theory and attachment with quantum physics, what we now know is that the emotions that the child felt at the time are bundled with it, and also any childhood conclusions that he came to at that time, say he was 4 years old, it's all stored together now as a bundle. So if that same music plays, you know, and that it triggers that bundle, that whole bundle, which is a template, which is a neural pathway on the subconscious mind, it will pull the whole thing forward and will relive it as the four-year-old. We may be 40 years old, but sometimes in our life, that four-year-old comes out and starts driving our bus. Mm. That's the trigger. That's what needs to be cleaned up. You know, going and talking to the other person was one way, but probably not the most effective way. You can't stand there and holler at the writing on the wall or at the others that did it, because it's never about the other.
That's true.
The problem is on our own wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the stuff that's stored on our wall. I mean, the story is long gone, but we keep reliving the story because this is etched, you know, as a neural pathway. I call them templates, you know, for an experience, and it's etched on our wall. And something can trigger that, and off we go, doing what we've always done, feeling what we've always felt, feeling rejected or, you know, that over-controlled or whatever that feeling is. And that's what happened in this man's case. The only way to clean that up, we know now with the new science of neuroplasticity, nothing is unchangeable on the mind. We can change those neural pathways. We can rip up those old templates and lay down new ones.
Okay. That's a great place for some to say we should end, but I'm not going to. How do we do that? I mean, that seems so monumental. It's one thing to go back and relive the events and understand why we are the way we are. That's one thing. But now, I now know what the template is for this particular reaction. How do I tear it up, deconstruct it, and then construct a, shall we say, a more modern template 2.0, if you will serve me and my life's purpose?
Thank you for asking. Richard, at the end of each chapter, there are 12 chapters in our book, and each chapter in the book is part of the puzzle. Okay, we recommend that you read it from the beginning to the end. At the end of each chapter, there's a wonderful self-help portion in there. There's opportunities, there's lists of questions that are going to help you. It's certainly explained well. Part of what Dimitri and I wanted to get across in the book was there's lots of books written on the different parts that we have in the chapters, but there was nothing pulling it all together, and there certainly wasn't anything that was giving us engagement or incentive to understand how the mind works. And why does it work the way that it does? Why did we come with an operating system but with a blank database? You know, and how did that database become a functioning database? We describe all of this in the book, and then we take you through each and every one of the processes, and there's lots and lots of opportunities in the book that opportunities to free yourself, to opportunities to become, to really understand who you all are and or who everyone is, and lead us to higher levels of consciousness. So what I would suggest is follow the processes in the book. Over and above the book, we have now written the a workbook for this book. It'll be available in April. You'll be able to get it on all the same sources. And we started doing chapter courses as well, online courses at Eudaimonia. You'll see all of this on our website, which is themindofthemap.com.
Hmm. Mindofthemap.com is the website. And before we wrap up, I do want to touch on one other element in the book that is currently available, the workbook coming. Christina, what about... and actually, you touched upon this a little bit when you were talking about your sabbatical. What about this aspect of journaling? Why and how? Why is it so important? And how much should we put into these journals? What should we be putting into these journals? And not on Facebook. Not on social media.
Yes, right. Not on social media. Everything and anything that comes up for you. Consider your journal as your best friend, but also consider that this is not a judgment journal. This is not something where you criticize yourself or you judge yourself or others. This is a journal that helps you learn who you are, helps you discover what that writing on the wall is. Journal what the critical voice says to you. You know, write it down. There are questions in the book that are going to ask you, do you believe what the critical voice said? If not, why not? You know, where do you think that, or where do you feel that this voice came from? When was the first time you heard this voice? These kinds of things. They're all in there. Your journal is going to be your best friend. On one side, it's going to be your best friend, but take that journal further and sit down and have meetings with your friends. Discuss your journal. Discuss their journal. Use active listening and keep your heart wide open while you support and help each other. It's a process of discovery. It's a personal discovery process. You know, like the inscription on the temple at Delphi, you know thyself. That's the key to everything. Mm. Know thyself. Love thyself and know thyself.
Yeah. Well, Christina, I want to thank you so much for giving us so much time here on the program. This has just been extraordinary, and there's certainly much more that we could be talking about as well. We could be touching upon so many different areas, including how to use the power of connection to share experiences and develop greater insights, how 1 hour of worry can cause the brain's neural pathways to double in strength, which you did talk about, which journaling techniques we talked about just now connect us directly to our heart, and where the voice in our minds comes from. Oh, that's a good question. And how 9 simple questions can launch a process of transformation. And by the way, the word transformation, I'd been using over a long period of time when we would talk about raising our consciousness and changing our lives. And I would constantly be using the word change. And one of my guests said, you know what? If you change it, it can be changed back. But if you transform it, I suppose someone could semantically say, well, I suppose it could be transformed back, right? Well, I use
that's
the...
a very good point. But we lay down the new tracks, okay,
yeah.
For new thought, new beliefs, new habits. What's going to happen is the only way to lift those tracks is to go through the same process again.
Exactly.
It stays there.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It sticks there. It's the stickability of the program. Wonderful.
Yeah.
We would have to rip it all up and then lay down something else. But once we lay it down, it's going to stay there unless we consciously rip it up again, which mm-hmm. we can do if we want. But
yeah.
Why would we do that?
Yeah, exactly. I again, thank you so much. And should you find yourself... They're coming across the border down here into the southwestern part of the country. We'd love to have you in studio here in Santa Barbara to continue this conversation.
You know, I love the title of your program, and it's programs like yours, Richard, that really are the cutting edge and set a very good foundation for us moving forward and creating a new story for humanity. I want to thank you so much for
your
commitment to the work that you do. This has been a wonderful, meaningful conversation here today, and I'm so happy that you invited me to be on behalf of Dimitri and myself.
Well, I'm hoping that one day we will even get him on this program as well.
Yes, that's a possibility.
Yeah.
He just came back from Spain, so yes.
Wonderful, wonderful. And then I have three final questions for you, but I want to remind our listeners, the website, once again, is themindisthemap.com, and the book, The Mind is the Map. Awareness is the compass, and the emotional intelligence is the key to living meaningful, living mindfully from the heart. And again, my guest has been Christina Reeves. And Christina, before I let you go, the last three questions for you here on the program, at least for today. First is, who is Christina Reeves?
Who is Christina Reeves? You know what? My favorite answer is, Richard, I am you. When someone looks at me across the table and I say, you know, who do you see? And they say, well, I see this, and they start giving attributes or criticism, you know, of who I am or whatever, I look back at them and I'll say, you know what I see? When I look at you, I see me.
Second question, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
This is a work of service, you know, and that's exactly why I have jumped out of the small pond and into the big pool, if you will say so, by coming out with a book with Dimitri and now the school. And we want to be there. We can't fix another, you know, but what we can do is walk with them. You know, I've been doing this for 15 years with others. I have trained other teachers in these methods. I have worked with health people in the health field, teaching them these methods. And what I really want to do is spread the word. We are currently translating the book into Greek and a few other languages, and setting up and teaching train the trainers, I suppose, to start holding these courses and classes in their countries and in their language. And that's where I'd like to go with this. It's actually been a dream. I wrote a curriculum about 16 years ago of what I thought should be taught in the school system. Well, that didn't happen. So here I am doing it myself. Not myself. I have a team, and of course, Dimitri is my partner.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life purpose? That's a good one. You know, all of our life purpose is to protect our soul, to heal our souls, and to remember that we're all one. We're all united. There is no differences. We need to come together in unity. I think that's why there's a lot of us on the earth plane right now that are doing exactly that. You know, we are bringing the concept of unity back. You know, there was a time in the beautiful garden where unity was all that there was, and everyone lived in unity. And somehow we've all become separate. There's those me's and those we's, and I'd like to be part of the we team. So that's my path.
Well, Christina Reeves, once again, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and we look forward to having you back here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, as we give people choices and knowledge of those choices to help make their dreams come true. And until next time, love, Talal.